Welcome to the History of Chemistry podcast. I'm Steve Cohen, your host, and this is episode 116, Open Frame of Mind, on the origin of metal organic frameworks. Thanks to those who already support this podcast. Support the continuation of this podcast at Patreon. The website is www.patreon.com/thehistoryofchemistry. The 20th century for chemistry included a realization that large molecules and collections of molecules do all kinds of things with different properties than the small molecules envisioned in the 19th century. Besides polymers, liquid crystals and cellular membranes, DNA and protein synthesis, we now turn to another great example of ultra-large molecular structures, so-called metal organic frameworks. We might regard the earliest origins of metal organic frameworks as the synthesis of Prussian blue, the first artificial pigment in the form of a complex, by Johann Dippel in the first decade of the 1700s. After that, the actual molecular structure of such metallic complexes was figured out in the 1890s by Alfred Werner, describing a central metallic ion surrounded by small molecules. These are topics we've heard about in this podcast. But now let's turn to a different structure. German chemist Karl Hoffmann discovered a material in 1897. He reported the reaction of benzene diffusing into a solution of nickel dicyanide in ammonia, which gave a crystal of the formula NiNC2NH3, all together with C6H6. Herbert Marcus Powell, English crystallographer, who invented the term clathrate, from Latin clathratus, closed or protected by crossbars of a trellis, and clathry, a trellis which encloses anything generally, in the 1940s, and worked out the crystal structure by 1952. Hoffmann's compound became called Hoffmann's clathrate. It has an interesting structure. Instead of a single central complex, it's a two-dimensional complex. There are layers of nickel atoms, ammonia molecules surrounding them, and cyanide ions. In between these layers are benzene molecules. The whole system may immediately remind you of the intercalation compounds for lithium batteries. In the late 1960s, Toshikate Iwamoto's group in Tokyo researched more on these Hoffmann clathrate materials, coming to the realization that you can make these compounds with two separate units, a divalent metal cation inside a tetrahedral group of four cyanates, and a divalent metal cation in a complex with two ammonia molecules. Some of these ammonias can be switched out with aromatic molecules to build a layered structure inside which other molecules can be enclosed. Aha! Now, can you just remove the coordination parts, get rid of the cyanates and ammonias and such, and connect metal cations directly with organic molecules? Yoshihiko Saito and co-workers at the Toyo Rayon Company in Japan were able to do just this in 1959 using copper cations and bis-alkylonitrilo organic units. The organic parts linked to the copper atoms in a tetrahedral way, four organic parts to each copper atom. Depending on the organic units, you could make networks with small holes, or medium or even larger holes within the network. But right around this time at DuPont, in 1965, E.A. Tomic reported yet a further extension of this layered system in the Journal of Applied Polymer Science. Tomic took several metal cations, zinc, nickel, aluminum, iron, thorium, and uranium, and built polymers using organic pieces, 1,5-dihydroxynaphthalene, 2,6-dicarboxylic acid, pyromelitic acid, and 2,3,6,7-naphthalene tetracarboxylic acid. These are benzene ring-containing organic molecules with reactive groups sticking out. The reactive groups can donate electrons to the metal cations. Essentially, you can imagine Tomic's molecule as a large extended organometallic array built like a Kinex, Meccano, or Erector set framework. The metal ions are connector pieces, and the organic molecules are connecting rods. Perhaps the best known naturally occurring analog to this is a zeolite. A zeolite is an inorganic mineral made of aluminum combined with tetrahedral units of silicate, or silicon plus 4 oxygen atoms. The zeolite structure combines these units into large arrays with definite pores, into which smaller molecules like water can reside. In fact, the name zeolite was invented by our buddy, the Swedish blowpipe inventor Axel Kronstedt, in 1756, from Greek zeo, to boil, and lithos, stone. When Kronstedt heated up this kind of mineral, large amounts of steam came out. To this day, zeolites are used as membranes to sort large molecules from small ones, to absorb gases and other small molecules, and even as catalysts. But here, Tomic invented not an inorganic structure, but an organometallic structure with organic rods attached to metal ions in a regular way. The new molecule was vaguely interesting to chemists, but it seems little happened in the world of chemistry with this new polymer for decades. Chemists for a long time thought that Tomic and similar researchers could not get these organometallic polymers to be stable either in their structure or in their chemical properties. Making these structures was pricey, and they could be synthesized in only small amounts, so they were not commercially viable. There was some research after Tomic's paper. For example, in 1986, German chemist Siegfried Hünig's team synthesized an electrically conductive material with an organic anion and copper cation. The overall structure was tetrahedral with a diamond-like crystal lattice. Several years later, in 1989, Japanese researcher Akiko Kobayashi reported similar materials with this lattice structure. The following year, another Japanese chemist, Makoto Fujita, synthesized a molecular two-dimensional grid in the following way. He made a cadmium complex with some organic parts, which he was able to connect in squares using a double benzene ring with nitrogen atoms in the rings, and this made a huge endless 2D network like a screen. By the early 1990s, though, chemistry and engineering were searching for new ways to reliably filter molecules of different sizes. Zeolites were and are somewhat limited in their size of their pores, generally 2 nanometers or smaller, and what molecules could be absorbed. Rediscovery of metal organic frameworks occurred through the work of Palestinian-American Saudi chemist Omar Yaghi. In 1999, he published an article in the journal Nature called Design and Synthesis of an Exceptionally Stable and highly porous metal organic framework. Often called MOF5, it's a framework of zinc oxide tetrahedra connected in a three-dimensional grid by dimethyl formamide organic units. Inside that 3D framework are cavities 1.85 nanometers in diameter. Yagi was able to get argon atoms, as well as nitrogen, dichloromethane, trichloromethane, benzene, carbon tetrachloride, and cyclohexane molecules all to fit into the array of cavities. He showed that the pores themselves were 0.8 nanometers in diameter. Yagi himself invented the phrase metal organic framework. Chemists were initially skeptical of this structure. It's so open and spacious, like the interior of a Gothic cathedral. What keeps it from collapsing, especially if you remove the gas molecules stored in the pores? Partly, it's because of strong zinc oxygen, carbon oxygen, and carbon-carbon bonds. Partly, it's because the connecting nodes are flexible in certain directions but not in others, and the three-dimensional array compensates in all directions for that flexibility, leading to a rigid structure. So what really are metal organic frameworks? There are two major parts: a small inorganic cluster containing inorganic and metallic atoms. This cluster acts as a connection node. The other necessary part is an organic linking molecule, which you can imagine as a rod that spans from cluster to cluster. MOF5, for example, has clusters of four zinc atoms plus an oxygen atom, all together having a +6 charge. Among the organic linking rods can be molecules with one benzene ring and acid groups on opposite sides, two or even three fused benzene rings plus these acid groups, two benzene rings linked by a single bond, three benzene rings linked by single bonds, long organic molecules with benzene rings and triple bonds, long V-shaped organic molecules, large triangular organic molecules composed of four benzene rings, and even more. It all depends on how big you want the pores and the chemical reactivity inside the pores. Topologically, a description and classification of these materials is grounded in the 1950s papers by Alexander Wells, an employee of the famous British ICI company. His 1954 paper in the journal Acta Cristallographica discusses all sorts of repeating crystal lattices, and this is what we have in metal organic frameworks, just as inorganic salts form a regular crystal lattice of ions. Interestingly, Wells also described crystal lattices as connections between nodes and links. Since 1995, but especially after 2005, the number of known metal organic frameworks has jumped dramatically, now numbering around 100,000 different materials. Let's examine some of the properties of these interesting chemicals. They are porous. The IUPAC, International Union of Pure and Applied Chemistry, classifies materials as nanoporous, pores smaller than 2 nanometers, mesoporous, pores between 2 and 50 nanometers, and microporous, pores larger than 50 nanometers. Chemists can measure how well metal organic frameworks absorb gases by recording a physisorption isotherm. This is jargon that means you hold the metal organic framework at a cryogenic temperature, such as minus 196 degrees Celsius or minus 186 degrees Celsius, which is at or just above liquid nitrogen's boiling point. Then you apply the gas to the metal organic framework at different pressures and see how much the material can take up. The plot of amount of gas absorbed on the vertical axis versus the gas pressure on the horizontal axis generally shoots up, then bends over horizontally. Based on the organic rods you choose, you can design a metal organic framework with pores of a desired size, or even with a couple of different known sizes. With that in mind, you can use these for separating different compounds. There is research into using metal organic frameworks to sop up residual antibiotics or heavy metals in water treatment systems, lakes, and rivers, or pulling polluting gases out of exhaust from chemical plants. You can use them to harvest water out of other materials. You can use them for catalysis to speed up other reactions. You can use them in sensors to detect certain chemicals in the environment, because you can design the interior framework to attract certain atomic or molecular groups. You might use them to hold drugs inside and release them in the appropriate digestive environment, assuming you can find a non-toxic framework. You can just use them to store gases. If you attach enzymes to rigid frameworks, you can use them under harsher conditions like more acid or alkali, or higher temperatures with less degradation. Because these frameworks can store gases, there is research into using them as a storage medium for hydrogen gas to use as an ecologically friendly fuel. We may talk of hydrogen fuel in a future episode. You can also imagine these frameworks as a basis for building batteries in the same way that intercalation compounds now are used. Depending on the materials you choose to build your metal organic framework, you can even choose if it is luminescent, giving interesting optical properties. You can choose if the structure is magnetic, so you can merely put a magnet near your solution and draw the frameworks out. You might be able to build in certain electrical conductivity, or if it acts like a semiconductor. In sum, if you want to ask why chemists can't just build little structures like children with blocks, the answer is now they can, more or less, using the metal organic framework rubric. I suspect we will hear a lot more about metal organic frameworks in the 21st century. In our next episode, we return to that basic iconic chart in chemistry, the periodic table, and see what kinds of different diagrams chemists have invented to better portray periodic properties of the elements. Until then, brave the elements! Thank you for listening to the History of Chemistry podcast.